Do you feel a shiver up your spine from fear? Yes, it's another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind. Amp up your imagination and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Music of Eric Zahn by H.P. Lovecraft. I've examined maps of the city with the greatest care, yet have never again found the Rue d'Assay. These maps have not been modern maps alone, for I know that names change. I have, on the contrary, delved deeply into all the antiquities of the place, and have personally explored every region of whatever name which could possibly answer to the street I knew as the Rue d'Assay. But despite all I have done, it remains a humiliating fact that I cannot find the house, the street, or even the locality where, during the last months of my impoverished life as a student of metaphysics at the university, I heard the music of Eric Zahn. That my memory is broken, I do not wonder, for my health, physical and mental, was gravely disturbed throughout the period of my residence in the Rue d'Assay, and I recall that I took none of my few acquaintances there. But that I cannot find the place again is both singular and perplexing, for it was within a half hour's walk of the university, and was distinguished by peculiarities which could hardly be forgotten by anyone who had been there. I have never met a person who has seen the Rue d'Assay. The Rue d'Assay lay across a dark river bordered by precipitous brick, blear-windowed warehouses, and spanned by a ponderous bridge of dark stone. It was always shadowy along the river, as if the smoke of neighboring factories shut out the sun perpetually. The river was also odorous with evil stenches, which I have never smelt elsewhere, and which may some day help me to find it, since I should recognize them at once. Beyond the bridge were narrow cobbled streets with rails, and then came the ascent, at first gradual, but incredibly steep as the Rue d'Assay was reached. I have never seen another street as narrow and steep as the Rue d'Assay. It was almost a cliff, closed to all vehicles, consisting in several places of flights of steps, and ending at the top in a lofty ivied wall. Its paving was irregular, sometimes stone slabs, sometimes cobblestones, and sometimes bare earth with struggling greenish-gray vegetation. The houses were tall, peak-roofed, incredibly old, and crazily leaning backward, forward, and sideways. Occasionally an opposite pair, both leaning forward, almost met across the street like an arc, and certainly they kept most of the light from the ground below. There were a few overhead bridges from house to house across the street. The inhabitants of that street impressed me peculiarly. At first I thought it was because they were all silent and reticent, but later decided it was because they were all very old. I do not know how I came to live on such a street, but I was not myself when I moved there. I had been living in many poor places, always evicted for want of money, until at last I came upon that tottering house in the Rue d'Assay, kept by the paralytic Blandot. It was the third house from the top of the street, and by far the tallest of them all. My room was on the fifth story, the only inhabited room there, since the house was almost empty. On the night I arrived, I heard strange music from the peak garret overhead, and the next day asked old Blandot about it. He told me it was an old German viol player, a strange dumb man who signed his name as Eric Zahn, and who played evenings in a cheap theater orchestra, adding that Zahn's desire to play in the night after his return from the theater was the reason he had chosen this lofty and isolated garret room, whose single gable window was the only point on the street from which one could look over the terminating wall at the declivity and the panorama beyond. Thereafter I heard Zahn every night, and although he kept me awake, I was haunted by the weirdness of his music. Knowing little of the art myself, I was yet certain that none of his harmonies had any relation to music I had heard before, and conclude that he was a composer of highly original genius. The longer I listened, the more I was fascinated, until after a week I resolved to make the old man's acquaintance. One night, as he was returning from his work, I intercepted Zahn in the hallway and told him that I would like to know him and be with him when he played. He was a small, lean, bent person, with shabby clothes, blue eyes, grotesque, satyr-like face, and nearly bald head, and at my first word seemed both angered and frightened. My oblivious friendliness, however, finally melted him, and he grudgingly motioned me to follow him up the dark, creaking, and rickety attic stairs. His room, one of only two in a steeply pitched garret, was on the west side towards the high wall that formed the upper end of the street. Its size was very great, and seemed the greater because of its extraordinary bareness and neglect. Of furniture, there was only a narrow bed, a dingy washstand, a small table, a large bookcase, an iron music rack, and three old-fashioned chairs. Sheets of music were piled in disorder about the floor. The walls were of bare boards and had probably never known plaster, while the abundance of dust and cobwebs made the place seem more deserted than inhabited. Evidently, Erich Zahn's world of beauty lay in some far cosmos of the imagination. Motioning me to sit down, the dumb man closed the door, turned a large wooden bolt, and lighted a candle to augment the one he had brought with him. He now removed his violin from its moth-eaten covering, and taking it, seated himself in the least uncomfortable of the chairs. He did not employ the music rack, but offering no choice and playing from memory, enchanted me for over an hour with strains I had never heard before. Strains which must have been of his own devising. To describe their exact nature is impossible. For one unversed in music, they were a kind of fugue, with recurrent passages of the most captivating quality, but to me were notable for the absence of any of the weird notes I had overheard from my room below on other occasions. Those haunting notes I had remembered, and had often hummed and whistled inaccurately to myself, so when the player at length laid down his bow, I asked him if he would render some of them. As I began my request, the wrinkled satyr-like face lost the bored placidity it had possessed during the playing, and seemed to show the same curious mixture of anger and fright which I had noticed when first I accosted the old man. For a moment I was inclined to use persuasion, regarding rather lightly the whims of senility, and even tried to awaken my host's weirder mood by whistling a few of the strains to which I had listened the night before. But I did not pursue this course for more than a moment, for when the dumb musician recognized the whistled air, his face grew suddenly distorted with an expression wholly beyond analysis, and his long, cold, bony right hand reached out to stop my mouth and silence the crude imitation. As he did this, he further demonstrated his eccentricity by casting a startled glance toward the lone curtain window, as if fearful of some intruder, a glance doubly absurd since the garret stood high and inaccessible above all the adjacent roofs, this window being the only point on the steep street, as the concierge had told me, from which one could see over the wall at the summit. The old man's glance brought Blandot's remark to my mind, and with a certain capriciousness I felt a wish to look out over the wide and dizzying panorama of moonlit roofs and city lights beyond the hilltop, which of all the dwellers in the Rue d'Orsay only this crab musician could see. I moved toward the window, and would have drawn aside the nondescript curtain, when a frightened rage, even greater than before, the dumb lodger was upon me again, this time motioning with his head toward the door as he nervously strove to drag me thither with both hands. Now thoroughly disgusted with my host, I ordered him to release me and told him I would go at once. His clutch relaxed, and as he saw my disgust and offense, his own anger seemed to subside. He tightened his relaxing grip, but this time in a friendly manner, forcing me into a chair, then with an appearance of wistfulness, crossing to the littered table, where he wrote many words with a pencil in the labored French of a foreigner. The note which he finally handed me was an appeal in tolerance and forgiveness. He said that he was old, lonely, and afflicted with strange fears and nervous disorders connected with his music and with other things. He had enjoyed my listening to his music and wished I would come again and not mind his eccentricities, but he could not play to another his weird harmonies and could not bear hearing them from another, nor could he bear having anything in his room touched by another. He had not known until our hallway conversation that I could overhear his playing in my room, and now asked me if I would arrange with Blandot to take a lower room where I could not hear him in the night. He would, he wrote, defray the difference in rent. As I sat deciphering the execrable French, I felt more lenient towards the old man. He was a victim of physical nervous suffering, as was I, and my metaphysical studies had taught me kindness. In the silence there came a slight sound from the window. The shutter must have rattled in the night wind, and for some reason I started almost as violently as did Eric Zahn. So when I had finished reading, I shook my host by the hand and departed as a friend. The next day Blandot gave me a more expensive room on the third floor between the apartments of an aged moneylender and the room of a respectable upholsterer. There was no one on the fourth floor. It was not long before I found that Zahn's eagerness for my company was not as great as it had seemed. He was persuading me to move down from the fifth story. He did not ask me to call on him, and when I did call, he appeared uneasy and played listlessly. This was always at night. In the day he slept and would admit no one. My liking for him did not grow, though the attic rooms and the weird music seemed to hold an odd fascination for me. I had a curious desire to look out of that window, over the wall and down the unseen slope, at the glittering roofs and spires which must lie outspread there. Once I went up to the garret during theater hours when Zahn was away, but the door was locked. What I did succeed in doing was to overhear the nocturnal playing of the dumb old man. At first, I would tiptoe up to my old fifth floor, then I grew bold enough to climb the last creaking staircase to the peak garret. There in the narrow hall, outside the bolted door with a covered keyhole, I often heard sounds which filled me with an indefinable dread, the dread of vague wonder and brooding mystery. It was not that the sounds were hideous, for they were not, but that they held vibrations suggesting nothing on this globe of earth, and that at certain intervals they assumed a symphonic quality which I could hardly conceive as produced by one player. Certainly Eric Zahn was a genius of wild power. As the weeks passed, the playing grew wilder, while the old musician acquired an increased haggardness and furtiveness pitiful to behold. He now refused to admit me at any time, and shunned me whenever we met on the stairs. Then one night, as I listened at the door, I heard the shrieking violin swell into a chaotic babble of sound, a pandemonium which could have led me to doubt my own shaking sanity had there not come from behind that barred portal a piteous proof that the horror was real. The awful, inarticulate cry, which only a mute can utter, and which rises only in moments of the most terrible fear or anguish. I knocked repeatedly at the door, but received no response. Afterward, I waited in the black hallway, shivering with cold and fear, till I heard the poor musician's feeble effort to rise from the floor by the aid of a chair. Believing him just conscious after a fainting fit, I renewed my rapping, at the same time calling out my name reassuringly. I heard Zahn stumble to the window and close both shutters and sash, then stumble to the door, which he falteringly unfastened to admit me. This time his delight at having me present was real, for his distorted face gleamed with relief, while he clutched at my coat as a child clutches at its mother's skirts. Shaking pathetically, the old man forced me into a chair while he sank into another, besides which his vial and bow lay carelessly on the floor. He sat for some time inactive, nodding oddly, but having a paradoxical suggestion of intense and frightened listening. Subsequently, he seemed to be satisfied, and crossing to a chair by the table, wrote a brief note, handed it to me, and returned to the table, where he began to write rapidly and incessantly. The note implored me, in the name of mercy, and for the sake of my own curiosity, to wait where I was while he prepared a full account, in German, of all the marvels and terrors which beset him. I waited, and the dumb man's pencil flew. It was perhaps an hour later, while I still waited, and while the old musician feverishly written sheets still continued to pile up, that I saw Zahn start, as from the hint of a horrible shock. Unmistakably, he was looking at the curtain window and listening shudderingly. Then I half fancied I heard a sound myself. There was not a horrible sound, but rather an exquisitely low and infinitely distant musical note, suggesting a player in one of the neighboring houses, or in some abode beyond the lofty wall over which I had never been able to look. Upon Zahn the effect was terrible, for dropping his pencil suddenly, he rose, seized his viol, and commenced to rend the night with the wildest playing I had ever heard from his bow, save when listening at the barred door. It would be useless to describe the playing of Erich Zahn on that dreadful night. It was more horrible than anything I had ever heard, because I could now see the expression of his face, and could realize that this time the motive was stark fear. He was trying to make a noise, to ward something off, or drown something out. What I could not imagine, awesome though I felt it must be. The playing grew fantastic, delirious, and hysterical, yet kept to the last the qualities of supreme genius, which I knew this strange old man possessed. I recognized the air. It was a wild Hungarian dance, popular in the theaters, and I reflected for a moment that this was the first time I had ever heard Zahn play the work of another composer. Louder and louder, wilder and wilder, mounted to the shrieking and whining of that desperate viol. The player was dripping with an uncanny perspiration, and twisted like a monkey, always looking frantically at the curtain window. In his frenzied strains, I could almost see shadowy satyrs and bacchanals dancing and whirling insanely through seething abysses of clouds and smoke and lightning. And then I thought I heard a shriller, steadier note that was not from the viol, a calm, deliberate, purposeful, mocking note from far away in the west. At this juncture, the shutter began to rattle, and a howling night wind, which had sprung up outside as if in answer to the mad playing within. Zahn's screaming viol now outdid itself, emitting sounds I had never thought a viol could emit. The shutter rattled more loudly, unfastened, and commenced slamming against the window. Then the glass broke shiveringly under the persistent impacts, and the chill wind rushed in, making the candles splutter and rustling the sheets of paper on the table where Zahn had begun to write out his horrible secret. I looked at Zahn and saw that he was past conscious observation. His blue eyes were bulging, glassy, and sightless, and the frantic playing had become a blind, mechanical, unrecognizable orgy that no pen could even suggest. A sudden gust, stronger than the others, caught up the manuscript and bore toward the window. I followed the flying sheets in desperation, but they were gone before I reached the demolished panes. Then I remembered my old wish to gaze from this window, the only window in the Rue d'Auxerre from which one might see the slope beyond the wall and the city outspread beneath. It was very dark, but the city lights always burned, and I expected to see them there amidst the wind and rain. Yet, when I looked from that highest of all gable windows, looked while the candles spluttered and the insane viol howled with the night wind, I saw no city spread below, and no friendly lights gleam from remembered streets, but only the blackness of space, illimitable, unimagined space, alive with motion and music, and having no semblance of anything on earth. And as I stood there looking in terror, the wind blew out both the candles in that ancient peak garret, leaving me in impenetrable and savage darkness, with chaos and pandemonium before me and the demon madness of that night baying viol behind me. I staggered back in the dark, without the means of striking a light, crashing against the table, overturning a chair, and finally groping my way to the place where the blackness screamed with shocking music. To save myself and Erich Zahn, I could at least try, whatever the powers opposed to me. Once I thought some chill thing brushed me, and I screamed, but my scream could not be heard above the hideous viol. Suddenly, out of the blackness, the madly sawing bough struck me, and I knew I was close to the player. I felt a head touch the back of Zan's chair, and then found and shook his shoulder in an effort to bring him to his senses. He did not respond, and still the vial shrieked on without slackening. I moved my head to his head, whose mechanical moaning I was able to stop, and shouted in his ear that we must both flee from the unknown things of the night. But he neither answered me nor abated the frenzy of his unutterable music, while all through the garret strange currents of wind seemed to dance in the darkness and babble. When my hand touched his ear, I shuddered, though I knew not why. Knew not why till I felt the still face, the ice-cold, stiffened, unbreathing face, whose glassy eyes bulged uselessly into the void. And then, by some miracle, finding the door and the large wooden bolt, I plunged wildly away from that glassy-eyed thing in the dark, and from the ghoulish howling of that accursed vial, whose fury increased even as I plunged. Leaping, floating, flying down those endless stairs, through the dark house, racing mindlessly out into the narrow, steep, and ancient street of steps and tottering houses, clattering down steps and over cobbles to the lower streets and the putrid canyon-walled river, panting across the great dark bridge to the broader, healthier streets and boulevards we know. All those are terrible impressions that linger with me, and I recall that there was no wind, and that the moon was out, and that all the lights of the city twinkled. Despite my most careful searches and investigations, I have never since been able to find the Rue d'Auxerre, but I'm not wholly sorry, either for this or for the loss and undreamable abysses of the closely written sheets which alone could have explained the music of Eric Zahn. The Ghost Farm by Susan Andrews Rice. When Stephen was killed, we did not know it until nearly 30 days afterward. He went overseas in April, and it was the last of June before we knew he went out with a party of engineers to repair the railroad track and was blown to pieces by a German shell. We could not tell Mady the truth. She knew he was dead, but concerning the manner of his going, she was ignorant. They were engaged. Her love for him amounted to adoration. She was an intense, emotional girl, bound to be unhappy because of her sensitive nature and strong feelings. She was under my professional care for several weeks, the latter part of the summer, suffering from a broken ankle. It is the silence, the awful blank wall between Stephen and me, that drives me frantic. She burst out one day when I was making her a visit. She had been reading a letter from Stephen, and it lay in her lap. She had a little package of his letters always near her. I know, I returned with a sigh. I, too, had lost my nearest and dearest. I wish I could consult a medium, she said, lowering her voice. How wonderful it would be to receive a message from him. I could hardly bear it, I'm afraid. Don't do it, Mady, I said. Better leave such people alone. The Ouija board, then. It seems rather like a silly game, but I shook my head. That way madness lies, I quoted. I wouldn't, Mady. Stephen lives in your heart, in your memories of him. She smiled, that pathetic little smile she had worn when she wished to appear cheerful. You're right, she answered, and changed the subject. In spite of what she had said, I discovered she was reading everything she could find about spirit communication, although I never heard of her making any attempt to reach Stephen in that way. I was very busy that fall, with influenza cases, and Mady went into Red Cross work, and when the epidemic was over, I heard she had gone to California. She returned early the following summer, looking haggard and ill. I prescribed for her, but could find nothing really wrong with her. She took long walks, and her mother told me she always went alone and resented any offer of companionship. She thought it queer, and said she feared Mady was drifting into melancholia. Mady came into my office one afternoon, and I was struck with a change in her expression. She looked happy and young. The strained misery had vanished from her face. I was puzzled. Could she have fallen in love? I ran over in my mind a list of her young men acquaintances, but none of them could I see as Mady's lover. Her mother had informed me her walks were always in one direction. Thinking of that, I asked, "Why do you always walk along the river road, Mady?" She turned a vivid pink. "You won't understand, I know, but I'm going to tell you," she replied, twisting her gloves in her hands. "In the first place, you must know Stephen and I used to plan that when we were married. We would own a little farm, just a little summer place, you know. He used to say every man wanted to have a farm. Doctor, when I go up the river road, just past the schoolhouse, on the bank, where the road turns into the woods, I see a little farm. The fields are neat and cultivated. The house is painted white with green blinds, and the doors open into the hall, as if people live there. Hollyhocks are growing around the kitchen door. On a table, milk pans are turned up to dry in the sun. There are some dish towels drying on a line, and at any moment I expect to see Stephen come around the corner of the house. I feel he is there, out of my sight. I wait and listen. He hasn't come yet, but he will some day, and when he comes, I shall go with him. Her face was luminous with joy. What could I say? What I to say? Do you think I could see the farm if I were with you? I asked, speaking slowly. I'm afraid you couldn't, she replied. No one knows it's there but Stephen and me. Then, my dear matey, it exists only in your imagination, I told her gently. She smiled, as one smiles at a child who doubts one's words, and she went away. I studied her case carefully. A good psychoanalyst might have helped her, but I was not skillful in that method of treatment. I see now that we did wrong in circumventing her. In accordance with my advice, her friends attempted to divert her attention from her daily walk. She was taken on automobile excursions. Visitors came at that hour of the day. She was invited to go to moving pictures. Duties were crowded upon her in the hope of altering the fixed idea in her mind of Stephen's waiting at the ghost farm. She was very sweet about acceding to demands and requests, though sometimes she would obstinately refuse to listen to them. August brought hot weather. The extreme heat wore upon our nerves. Everybody relaxed. Released from vigilant watchfulness, Matey left the house unnoticed. A terrific thunderstorm came up, and Matey's mother was beside herself. She had been lying down taking a nap when Matey slipped away. She telephoned to me when the shower was over, as Matey was not missed until then. I got out of my car and started up the river road, a sense of foreboding in the back of my mind. I had not proceeded far when a tire blew out. Impatiently, I left the machine and hurried on foot past the weather-beaten old schoolhouse a short distance. Suddenly, I stopped in my tracks. The sun had come out, and I saw the ghost farm. It was exactly as Matey had described it. A stretch of green fields, a small white house with green blinds, hollyhocks growing by the kitchen door, milk pans glistening in the sun drying on a table, towels fluttering on a line. I was struck dumb and stood motionless, hardly able to draw my breath at the strangeness of the scene. In a few minutes the vision or mirage vanished. Then I perceived a tall oak tree split in half by a bolt of lightning. The foot of the tree lay Matey on the wet ground, a smile of rapture on her upturned face. I knelt beside her and examined heart and pulse. Nothing could be done. Her spirit had left this earthly body. She had gone to be with Stephen. The Crimson Rosary by Wright Field. Something happened to some of us there in the trenches of war-torn France. A quickening of perception toward the unknown, a keening of the spiritual sensibilities, a thinning of the wall of flesh that ordinarily shuts us out from communication with the mystic forces of the invisible world that surrounds us. After a time, once we are back in contact with a matter-of-fact, prosaic, practical world, this apparent sixth sense seems to die of inanition. But at first, I can perhaps better elucidate my meaning by a tale that I shall unfold. I had been but 3 months away from the trenches when it happened. I was making a motor trip through Southern California at the time, and I come upon a deserted village. A village hoary with age, its humble adobe house buried in creepers that apparently had not been molested by the hand of man for more than a generation. I was making my way alone in a small car, and as evening was falling and I knew not how far it was to human habitation, I decided to spend at least a night there. One factor in my decision was my love for the ancient and the mysterious wherever I met with it. Scarcely any sign of the former inhabitants remained, and the place made me shudder with its similarity to a deserted and forgotten graveyard. It gave me the creeps just to walk about these streets of the dead, even with a hot California sun shining down upon the place. Back of the mission was a little cemetery, marked by some crosses that had long ago tottered from their bases, and wooden ones that had rotted into the mold. One house alone roused in me a more than passing interest and faint repulsion. Within this remained a huge wooden bed, stripped of furnishings, some other heavy furniture, and a picture or two. One of these was an oil painting of the Madonna, still bright, though it received the direct rays of the sun all morning, with a little altar beneath it. There was iron candlesticks of ancient pattern thereon, and under the picture was nailed a cross of crude design. There were some musty garments in an old chest, a woman's finery, and some coarse bits of crockery in a crude cupboard. The whole place bore the aspect of having been used at some time in the past, when the old village was inhabited. A piece of tapestry, which to my unpracticed eye seemed to have been of some value, still hung, rotting and ragged, before a door leading to an upper story. I tried the heavy wooden door, but it would not give, being fast locked, with a contrivance too modern to have been part of the original ruin. I chose this house for my temporary dwelling, feeling some slight sense of human companionship therein. I made a lazy vow as I stretched myself, after a supper of sorts, on the huge bed, with such bedding as I had provided, that I would break down the door and explore the house before going on my way on the morrow. I was awakened that night, perhaps near midnight, by the most alarming play of lightning it has been my ill fortune to witness, and this in Southern California, where thunderstorms are rare. Hardened as I had become to all phases of life, I quivered beneath the bedding as it smote the old walls with searing tongues of light. Finally, after a roll of thunder that seemed like the very voice of hell crying out to an implacable heaven, the whole room seemed filled with lambent flame, a flame which revealed to me a most astonishing thing. I was not alone in the old village. Beneath the altar of the Madonna knelt a woman. Hair of midnight blackness was wound high on her head. From it gleamed an ancient Spanish comb, from whose jewels the lightning flashed in tints of sapphire and rose. Her lace mantilla had fallen about her shoulders, which gleamed like ivory through its black meshes. Her perfectly rounded arms were lifted in white supplication to the picture face, which I could have sworn had taken on a look of living pity. The very eyes, so calm and moveless, seemed now to be turned upon the kneeling supplicant, while the painted lips moved in some accent of comfort. The unknown woman wore a short, full-skirted garment of black and scarlet, and a gay fringed silken Spanish shawl fell about her feet that were clad in tiny scarlet dancing slippers. I had time to think what an outlandish costume it was for the time and place, before it occurred to me to slip into my clothes and offer what aid and comfort I could. I knew not whether she had come, but it was evident that she had sought this place to worship, frightened by the storm, which was enough to make a stout heart quail, let alone that of a frail young woman. I sat very still for a time, not wishing to disturb her at her devotions, or speak unless she showed some sign of panic. Finally she rose slowly, slipping her mantilla over her head, and drawing the shawl about her slender, graceful form. Then she turned toward me, the still flashing rays of light, showing me a face of transcendent loveliness, and eyes of dark fire. She seemed to be perfectly aware of my presence, and stepped lightly toward me. I motioned her to come and sit beside me, on the bench I had chosen, in a sheltered corner. As she approached, I was aware of a faint, intangible, curious odor, reminiscent of some time or place that I could not determine. She glided toward me and sank upon the seat. In 5 minutes my arms were about her. I cannot give you any coherent account of the night that followed. I cannot quote a word of the endless conversations we had together. I cannot remember the feeling of her smooth flesh, the touch of her lips on mine, the sensations that pervaded me. I recall only the facts themselves. Something I had wanted all my life was given to me during those 3 nights, when time was not and life stood still, as at some crossroad, some quality of heart, brain, or spirit that no woman before or since has ever been able to give me. She too sensed to find in me some quality to which it seemed her other lovers had been strangers, although I could not quote a word she said. And still more strangely, I cannot now recall a single accent of her voice, as if I had never heard it at all, but merely sensed her thoughts in some occult manner. I knew that she conveyed to me a sad story of having been in the control of a man whom she had at first loved, then learned to fear and hate, and had often threatened her life. Over and over I pleaded with her to come away with me. Always the one answer met me: she could not. Although her whole soul cried out to leave this place of horrors and sorrow, she was bound fast here. By what tie, I could not tell, perhaps fears of the consequences should she leave this Pedro Gonzalez, who loved her with a fierce love that seeks to hurt, to imprison, to destroy, but knows not tenderness and pity. My love for her was all reverence, tenderness, and pity. Her love for me was a spiritual thing, like the love of an angel. I would not have hurt or harmed her for a million worlds. Hours we sat in each other's arms, while outside a storm raged, the rain falling in torrential streams, day and night. She always sat until I had fallen asleep from sheer weariness, and then glided away. Days I sought the village over frantically, hoping to meet her oppressor face to face, but found nothing, not even a footprint, which anyway the fierce rain would have eradicated. It was all I could do to stagger against it from house to house. Each night, when I had turned my head away from the entrance or was looking out of a window, she would suddenly appear. I knew not from where, or lay a soft arm about my neck, a touch met by every bounding pulse in my body. She kept faithfully the secret of her hiding place, so I came to believe it might be off in the dense forest somewhere, and only awaited the beginning of the storm to search until I could find and carry her away. When she was gone, I indulged in hours of fruitless smoldering hatred for this Pedro Gonzalez. When she was in my arms, I only loved her. There has never been another love like it. Combined with the earthly charms of a woman and the mystic charms of a saint, she appealed to the best side of my earthly nature and my spiritual, a dual lure that sometimes seemed to call the very soul out of my own body to mingle and merge with hers. It was at times as if our souls stood naked together and our bodies did not exist. I thought the storm seemed to have something to do with my feelings, for a storm always seems to me a supernatural manifestation, and it plays upon my nerves many strange tricks. But she did not seem frightened when she was in my arms, or when I but held her hand, and so the nights went by. It was near the end of the third night, during a sudden wild quickening of the pulse of the storm, which had somewhat abated for 2 or 3 hours, that she whirled without warning from my side and into a wild dance of such abandonment that I could only marvel. She seemed not something human, but a winged spirit of black and scarlet, a writhing, tortured, twisted flame, at times on her knees, pleading with something inexorable and implacable, again dashing to her scarlet toe-tips and flinging out defiant hands, as if challenging this imperious fate to do its worst. A sound flung out from her white throat that was neither laugh nor wail, but something between the two, a derisive, hysterical, mocking, shrilling sound that made my blood run cold. All at once our lovely intimacy, our dreamy romance, seemed at an end. She was no longer anything to me but a disembodied spirit of defiance, of sardonic woe, of unearthly mocking mirth. I sat stunned, again surprised, by that strange tantalizing odor, so reminiscent of something I could not place, some past experience. Suddenly, in her torture writhing, her shawl was flung aside, and her bodice half torn from her white bosom. I caught a glimpse of a red bloody scar, and saw also for the first time that she wore about her neck a common wooden rosary of a deep red color with a carved ivory cross hanging pendant on it. Suddenly, in a wild gyration, the cross was jerked from the rosary and fell at my feet. I stooped to pick it up. When I looked again, she was standing in the doorway that led to the upper regions, pushing back the rotted fall of tapestry with one slim white hand. I darted toward her to touch her once, just once. She waved me back, and imperiously I halted, as if held in my tracks by a mysterious power, superior to my own. Her lips moved. I caught a word. Mañana. Tomorrow. And she was gone. The door had opened at her touch. I made no effort to follow. I must have swooned where I stood, for when I came to myself in the light of a dazzling calm new day, I was lying cold and stiff on the hard stone floor. In my hand was still grasped a little carved ivory cross, whereon writhed a tiny, tortured Christ, so lifelike that I shuddered. I examined the door. The lock was rusted shut. I broke it down with my axe. Upstairs was a jumble of moldering finery flung from chests and boxes. An antique jewel case lay open, empty and broken on the floor. A woman's slipper and a painted fan, dim with age and dust, lay in one corner. There was no sound nor sign of life. I think I was not quite sane. I called to her. I beat and pounded upon the walls. There might be a secret door to some other apartment. At least I was rewarded by a hollow ring. Again, I beat with superhuman strength upon the adobe walls. Bits of clay fell at my feet. Again, more of the wall gave way. A wooden door came into view. I jerked it open again, that strange odor, reminiscent of I knew not what. God, even now, if I could forget, but I can't. Behind that door, hermetically sealed, for how many years I shall never know, crouched the girl in dancing costume. The sun reflected from her high Spanish comb in flashes of sapphire and rose. It showed the skin stretched like drying parchment over features, still beautiful and still recognizable, glittered back at me from the scarlet satin of her little slippers. It shone upon the hilt of a dagger stuck into the white bosom, and upon a wooden rosary, crimson still by the blood that had long ago dripped down upon it from the breast of a dying girl. But the cross had gone from the crimson rosary, and all at once I knew, I recognized, that strange tantalizing odor, a war-ravaged field in France, men lying long unburied, flesh drying on human bones. I do not know how I got away. I stumbled, I fell down those time-corroded stairs. Somehow I must have found the car and driven with a fury of a man with seven devils at his heels. I came to myself weeks later in a hospital in a town I shall not name. I never found, nor indeed sought, the path to that deserted village again. I made no effort to prove to my friends the story I told, and I flung into the sea, as a thing accursed, the carved ivory cross that I found in my pocket when I came back to life and reason.